Say you have a great interest in politics. You check political news throughout the day. You sit and watch at least one show about politics on TV. You sometimes shout back at the TV and post your thoughts on social media or elsewhere online. If that's the extent of your political activity, other than voting, you may be a political hobbyist. Our guest uses that term in his book. Eitan Hersh is the author of Politics is for Power, How to Move Beyond Political Hobbyism, Take Action, and Make Real Change. Eitan Hersh is an associate professor at Tufts University in the other Medford in Massachusetts. His teaching and research focus on American elections, voting rights, and civic participation. Eitan tells us he lives 2 miles from Fenway Park in Boston. Congratulations on that. Sorry about the Mookie Betts trade, and welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
I notice your book has the same publication date as Rick Wilson's Running Against the Devil. He comes from the Republican side. Do you approach this from a particular viewpoint?
Not really. You know, I'm a professor. I talk a little bit of my own political activity in the book, but I come at it from a perspective of someone who studies politics and looking at the ways that people are doing it, noticing something that I found kind of disturbing.
Well, now, the term political hobbyism, I mean, do you think that describes what a lot of politically or people who think of themselves as politically engaged really do?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the ways that most people spend time on politics, and we're at a time right now where more people are spending more energy and time on politics than just about any time ever. But if you sum up what they're doing, the news consumption, the online discourse, the ways that they engage in activism, it's a lot closer to sports fandom or another kind of rather shallow hobby, not to be too judgmental. We'll talk more about why that judgmental term is in there, than politics. I mean, politics is about working with other people with goals and strategies to influence the government. That definition just doesn't look like the ways that something like 90% of us are spending our time on politics.
All right, so just watching Laura Ingraham or Sean Hannity or Rachel Maddow, sorry, the name was escaping me there for a moment, not enough.
Not only not enough, it might be counterproductive.
Huh. Well, that was what I was going to ask. I mean, clearly political hobbyism doesn't necessarily help a political agenda. That's easy to see. Does it hurt?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people have this intuition that if they do politics this way, which is an easy way, following the news, obsessing about the latest turns, that it, you know, maybe one day it will spark them to do something else. But turns out that's probably not going to happen, because when you engage in political hobbyism, you're practicing the wrong skills and you're learning the wrong facts. So, you know, I think a lot of people have this experience. You know, if I go to someone who spends 2 hours a day in political news consumption and I say, oh, you know, great, I'm interested in getting involved and on some issue I care about, you know, climate change, economic development, whatever it is, you know, tell me about what's going on in the state on that. And then the person who's the political hobbyist kind of blushes and say, oh, you know, I don't know anything about that news, but I could tell you about the Mueller report and Sharpiegate and all sorts of nonsense that's just completely unrelated to one's own ability to participate in politics.
Well, then that's a really big point, though, right there, because the fact is that it does seem like people can name most of the members of Congress in their state, maybe not in California because there's so many of them, but probably can't name their own city council members.
Right. And, you know, the political process in any state or community is complicated. There are different rules and norms. And meanwhile, people are learning a ton, if they're obsessed with politics, about, you know, how the Iowa caucus works, because it's interesting and traumatic and there was a problem with it. But are they learning how the structure of power in their own community where they can be most influential? And the answer is mostly not.
So, there are examples of the people who do get involved and seek to help their neighbors, and they have a political agenda. I mean, it's interesting, because I always think about like Hezbollah in Lebanon and the way it springs into action when there's a bombing or a disaster. They do better than the government at helping people. But you've got examples from our own country of the Ku Klux Klan, for example, helping opioid addicts in North Carolina.
That's right. You know, there's a lot of examples in the book that are positive examples of people doing engagement what I think is the right way, and, you know, multiplying their own power, their own votes. And we see examples like this in, you know, obviously what I think is a not good organization, the Ku Klux Klan. But, you know, the Ku Klux Klan doesn't sell its ideology by just talking about its ideology. It's you know, not going to win over that many supporters with its noxious ideology. But if it's going on the streets like it did in 2018 and telling opioid addicts the addiction's not their fault and they're here to help them, and no one else in the political world is doing that, then they are going to win supporters. And so I use that example because I think folks on the left and right, but particularly on the left right now, are obsessed with, you know, big ideas, big reforms, get rid of the Electoral College, get rid of gerrymandering, give everyone health care. And for many voters whose support they need, that stuff is just, like, not relevant to their lives. But the groups that are going around and saying, you know, being empathetic with them and meeting with them where they are, whether those groups have good ideologies or bad, those are the ones that are going to move people in their direction. And I think a lot of the more mainstream folks in American politics right now are ceding ground to folks at the extremes who, frankly, want power more than the moderates want it and are willing to do everything from babysitting clinics to opioid clinics to, you know, just spending a lot of time building support in the grassroots to get there.
Eitan, do you see political hobbyism as a bigger issue for one party than the other?
Yeah, I think it's a bigger issue on the left. It's a common phenomenon among college-educated white news followers. That demographic right now is overwhelmingly Democratic. So it's a kind of politics that is both cosmopolitan and detached. I often give an example like this. You know, can you imagine getting involved to support a county judge race, you know, maybe a candidate who's 25, just came out of law school, with the long-term plan that maybe in 30 years that person might be able to be on the Supreme Court and influence national politics? And for a lot of people, I think more on the left and on the right, the idea of weighing in on or investing time in a county judge race is beneath them. It sounds, you know, not important enough, too parochial. And I think that's a problem if you have long-term goals in politics.
But parochial is good up to a point. It fixes potholes and things like that, right?
Not only does it fix potholes, but it creates a farm team for engaging in national political change. And it connects people to politics who don't and will never care about big ideas. That's not why they're interesting in politics, but they might connect to something that's a concrete help in their lives.
It's not like this is happening for the first time, as you point out, Eitan. There's a precedent here with, for example, the amateur Democrats of the 1950s. What were they up to?
Yeah, there's a very interesting bit of research in political science and history about this group called the amateurs, who in the 50s and 60s, there's kind of post-war liberal white professionals in big cities. And they were motivated because they didn't like the party machines that were corrupt and involved in city politics at the time. And so they wanted to kind of do something else. But they mistook, I think, how politics happens, because they were very into having kind of all-night gab fests in living rooms over drinks. They would bring in guest speakers. They would do that kind of politics. But they really thought that a lot of the stuff that the party machines were doing, you know, providing vaccines, providing free turkeys, that was both dirty and parochial. And I think that the idea that you would spend a lot of time on politics, talking about big issues, feeling emotional connections to what's happening in Washington, but not willing to dirty your hands, I think that really has expanded now to a world where we don't even do what the amateurs did. You know, we don't do community meetings, but from the comfort of our couches or with the grip of a phone, we try to feel some kind of emotional, intellectual connection to politics without, you know, obligating ourselves to other people or having any kind of theory of political change.
You really want readers to do some self-analysis here, don't you?
Yeah, and, you know, I did it myself. You know, this book is not a judgmental from the perspective of someone who, you know, is all about organizing. I come from the world of hobbyists. I know it well, and I know all the excuses because I have them myself. But, you know, the more I started understanding the alternatives, the folks who did got off their couch, and there's such a range of people with such fascinating stories about how they turned their one vote into 1,000, how they got people on board with them and what that was like. And the experience is riveting because I think it's so much more interesting and compelling and and approachable than the way many of us kind of look at activism from afar.
Well, so let's get some examples in here. We'll start in New York City with the group Changing the Conversation Together. What did they do?
Yeah, so I follow this woman, Lisa, who's around her 50 or so, and she is a liberal from Brooklyn. And every weekend, multiple times a weekend in some cases, during the 2018 election, she went over to Staten Island, which is a conservative area of the city, voted for Trump, and knocked on doors of people who she thought were Trump voters. And she's a very quiet, reserved person, and so it's like so unusual to see someone like that knocking on the door of their political opponents. But she practiced this idea of called deep canvassing, which is going to talk to your opponents, who strangers at the door, but not with a speech, not with judgment, but with an open ear focused mostly on listening and building rapport and trying to get this person to understand where you, the canvasser, is coming from, and also genuinely trying to understand where they're coming from. And the theory behind this is that, you know, if you're a Democrat and you hate Trump, some of the doors you're going to knock on are people of, you know, Fox News people who you're never going to convince. But a lot of people aren't like that, actually. A lot of people don't think that deeply about politics. They have views that, you know, they have, but they're not that firm and they're not that deep. And if you open yourself up to them and present them with empathy and a listening ear and kindness, you're going to win over some people's vote. So, you know, you might spend a whole day doing it and have two really great conversations. And is that a good use of your day? Well, you might have just turned your one vote into three. And for people like Lisa and her group, that's really meaningful. That's how change happens, one person at a time.
But it's important to think of it in terms of quality, not quantity. If you're thinking about completed presentations and numbers of people checked off your list, this is not what deep canvassing is about.
That's right. In fact, if you've ever been canvassed, or certainly if you've ever been canvassing, it's just nothing like what Lisa's doing over there. It's very, you know, it's 30 seconds, and you just can't wait to get away from the person and stop it, because it's not about a conversation. It's just about, like, let me get this speech over with.
Eitan Hersh is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Politics is for Power. So where did Changing the Conversation Together focus its efforts in the 2018 election, and what was the result?
So they focused almost entirely on Staten Island, and they worked to help get Max Rose elected, who's kind of a conservative Democrat war vet, in this one Republican area that remained in New York City. And Max Rose won that district, so now they have a Democratic representative there.
All right, that's the big result. But in individual conversations, what did the participants in the canvassing notice?
Well, you know, they convinced people. I mean, they had, it was over 1,000 of these kind of long, deep conversations, 20, 30, 40-minute long conversations. And the evidence suggests, and this is consistent with all the evidence, actually, that we have on this strategy of deep canvassing, is that the effects are there. These people moved in the direction of the canvassers. And most importantly, they're persistent. You know, sometimes, you know, you can see an effect in the world of political science. We measure things like this. You know, how effective is a campaign ad or a message at a door? And a lot of those effects, you know, they're there, but they last a day. But with deep canvassing, because it is really like getting into someone's, you know, into their heart, like they remember this long conversation they had with a kind person at the door, you see persuasive effects lasting a long time.
Does it take a different kind of personality from the person who would do canvassing in the past?
You know, it takes all of us to engage in real politics a whole different trait than we develop online. I mean, this is what's so amazing about, I think, real political participation, is that it is not an offline version of the antagonism and vitriol that happens online. Because the way to get power for anything that you care about, you know, it could be at a business meeting, it could be in a church, is the way to convince someone of doing something that you want them to do is by being nice to them and meeting them where they are. And we all know that, but we don't generally take that message to politics. We keep treating politics as this place of angry opposition. But the folks that I study in the book all know this kind of very simple fact, which is if you want to convince someone of something, you treat them with kindness. So I think they all cultivate that skill set. I don't think it takes, you know, just a political junkie or activist. You know, the people like Lisa doing this, it's not like they know the most facts necessarily about policy. That's not what this is focused on. It's focused on And listening ear and eye contact. And honestly, it's traits that all of us want to cultivate and sometimes need a little bit of a push to start doing more.
Which, you know, again, when we come back to what the political hobbyist does, it seems like the consumption of media is perhaps one of the main traits of a political hobbyist. And the media support this back, don't they?
That's right. We know, you know, they know, the media know what kind of headlines get attention. It's being provocative. You know, I wrote this piece. I've been writing a few op-eds about this, and you know, I wrote something about you know, the kind of the traits of hobbyists, and you know, the outlet that published this put the headline on it. Something, the headline was something like, you know, white liberals are ruining America. Okay, like I didn't put it that way, but you know, it got a lot of attention, and you know, and is it their fault? Well, not quite. We're the ones that like and share and retweet and comment on stuff like that. So, you know, I think in the world of news media, especially as it's gone to social media platforms, we're incentivizing the media and politicians to behave in this way that is kind of nasty.
Kind of blood sporty for sure. The book is called Politics is for Power. It's by Eitan Hersh, who is an associate professor at Tufts University in Massachusetts. The subtitle is How to Move Beyond Political Hobbyism, Take Action, and Make Real Change. Sound like you? Sound like something you're thinking about? Join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Ask your questions, make your comments at 800-838-3760 by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a phone call from Larry in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, morning, fellas. I was calling in to talk about a third way, but first to go over the two ways that have been discussed, this political hobbyism and cable news consumption. I just want to let people know C-SPAN is not Rachel Maddow or Sean Hannity. There are three great ways to obtain policy information if you were to put your time onto watching the three C-SPAN networks. Mm-hmm. And then we get to the other side of activism. I myself was a Democratic committeeman outside Philadelphia in a Republican district and did tons of person-to-person canvassing. So that, I think, those two things gives me the credibility to tell people this. The third way is if you're a liberal and you don't like fossil fuels and corporations, don't use fossil fuels. Don't invest in corporations. If you're a conservative and you don't like the welfare state, adopt children and through your church and so forth. Those kind of things can turn into real massive movements that will really change our society without being involved in either of the other two ways.
So model the behavior you want to see.
Be the change. Mm-hmm. Thanks, guys.
All right. Thank you, Larry. Appreciate that. Thoughts from you, Eitan?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good message. I think we're focused so much on politics as spectators that, you know, we're hoping that one day things will magically change. And I think the media, you know, promotes this line, you know, by focusing on this long-term plan, this kind of pie-in-the-sky idea that could, you know, make everything right again. In fact, for those, you know, opposed to President Trump, I think there's just been this constant feeling like any day now, this will all come to an end. And, you know, whether people had their hopes up about the Mueller report and the impeachment. And, you know, and so if you think that any moment now, and by the way, I think the cable news shows, particularly Rachel Maddow, really kind of pushes this point, like any moment now will be vindicated. Mm-hmm. Well, that's basically encouraging you not to do anything. And I think what the caller said, which is just right, is that, you know, it's really important to start from yourself, you know, not just living according to your own values, but realizing that your role in some national scandal is just not important. And so you can follow it, but your role is not important. Your messages, your tweets on Facebook, you know, your tweets, your Facebook posts, those aren't important. But your own ability to turn your vote into another vote, into 10 votes, into 100 votes, that's the realm of life where we actually are important, and we're important to other people, and people could rely on us to give them information and advice about how to actually change politics near them.
Interesting. So rather than a message of change could happen any day now, you know, like Larry said, be the change, do the changing yourself.
That's right.
So some of this stuff is just hard for to get people out of thinking in terms of our team versus their team. And you get into the whole, you know, as a guy who lives 2 miles from Fenway Park and cites this in his jacket bio. So the contrast, you know, the we hate the Yankees, we hate the Red Sox thing, because it seems like it is definitely leaked into politics. It's not sports, though.
No, and I think that any time you engage in politics at a local, even at a state level, you'll see that those divisions don't make any sense. You can't just, you know, it's very easy to vilify the other side and hate them. They're terrible people if you never have to interact with them. But the second, you know, suppose, you know, you have some issue you care about, you know, maybe it's climate, maybe it's racial equality, whatever it is. You start having your conversations about that in your own town or in your state, and you'll see that people who maybe identify the same party as you have a different view about these things than you have. And you have to deal with that and move them. And they're real people who have real concerns. And so you can't just vilify everybody. You have to start thinking about ways to connect with them. And I think the stories in the book, you know, some of them are really nonpartisan stories, like the elderly man, Nach Vasoki, who didn't even start political activity until his retirement. You know, it's clear that this is not about, you know, it's not strictly about Democrats versus Republicans beating the other side. It's about building power for what's interesting and important to you.
Let's talk about Nach Vasoki. This is the Russians of Brighton part of your book. What did he do to bring in votes for candidates?
So, you know, his story is just remarkable. He's a guy who came, a refugee, from first, you know, he was a Holocaust survivor and then a refugee from the former USSR. And he came to the U.S. and was kind of just a do-gooder in his community, you know, the kind of person who drives other retirees to doctor's appointments and helps fill out forms. And his English was a little bit better than other people. And so he and his wife were just kind of helpful around the low-income old age home where they lived. And in the 90s, he ended up getting involved politically because there was a law passed by Congress and President Clinton that was going to take benefits away from even from legal immigrants. People here are legally and living in nursing homes, they weren't going to get food stamps and things like that. And so the group mobilized, and eventually he turned that into political power. He and his wife helped to get 300 of their neighbors to pass a citizenship test. They studied with them. They studied the questions. And then he started with a group of people he called his lieutenants, but these were all just kind of old retirees from the former USSR. They organized for voting, so they would pass out a slate of candidates who folks should vote for, and they would knock on the doors in their building, and they would stand in the lobby. And soon enough, this precinct in this old age home had two or three times the voting rates of all the precincts around it. And basically everyone voted the same way. And this gave Nach Vasoki and his community a tremendous amount of power. Politicians were, you know, shoveling snow. They were driving him to the grocery store. They were responding to his calls and his issues, which were related to immigrant rights, but also really concrete things like mobility issues for the elderly. And, you know, what a legacy. This person didn't start any of this until his retirement. He did it until he was 98. He passed away just a few weeks ago, and I had the opportunity to be at his funeral, which, you know, when someone who's 99 passes away, funerals aren't necessarily so well attended. Most people he knew died. But at this funeral of about 50 people, in the front row was the mayor of Boston, the governor of Massachusetts, city councilors, state legislators, all paying tribute to someone who did something that's remarkable, but well within the bounds of what most people can do, which is building trust and rapport and then votes from their neighbors.
Acting like neighbors is the big part of that, I would think.
That's right.
So can, though, this sort of street-level retail politics, I mean, you know, there are a lot of people who feel like, well, this is not the place to do it because we've got to take care of the wave of money and advertising that we face nationally. So how do you counterbalance those two concerns?
Well, I think that you need durable organizations to overcome challenges. So one of the things that's very evident in the last year, say since the Obama election, I think people have a working memory of it, is that when the wind's at your back, you can get engaged. So, you know, people right after the Trump election on the left, super angry, and they're willing to go out to a protest. People right after the Obama election on the right, form the Tea Party, and they start getting active. But then the second the tides turn, you know, it's all over. So the Democrats were very excited about Obama in 2008. They knocked on his doors. They donated. And the second he's elected and they could actually implement what they cared about, everyone stays home. No one wants to go to a town hall meeting anymore. No one wants to, you know, show up to vote for a midterm election. And so you have the parties just flip-flopping back and forth in power because people are only willing to engage when there's some national moment or when there's a celebrity candidate. And I think what these organizations are doing that I profile are building relationships so the thing that's getting you out to vote or to be active is not some national saga or crisis or celebrity. It's the relationships you have with other people.
You mentioned the ways in which people get fired up in the negative sense, you know, the way that the Tea Party arose after the Obama election. And I guess we can use Indivisible as a parallel after the Trump election. Why do these groups form rather than people get involved in the existing party structures?
Well, I think the party structures are, for the most part, quite weak. And sometimes I think large-scale protests are easy to get people to show up for a one-time thing, and harder to transition that into a long-term strategy. So, you know, in the book I talk about protests that are strategic versus protests that are cathartic. And, you know, when you go to a protest and the whole goal is to kind of let off steam and be in a brief sense of camaraderie, that's a protest focused on catharsis. But protests, you know, when done right, are just the beginning of an opportunity to engage in organizing, that they're an opportunity to recruit, to build supporters. And so I think that there is a sense in politics right now, particularly focused online, but sometimes offline in some of these marches and protests, where the whole goal is to feel this emotional connection, to feel this catharsis, that the feeling sometimes, the emotion, provides a shortcut to being engaged without being engaged itself.
You were talking earlier about the concept of getting somebody elected, for example, to a local judgeship at age 25 with an eye that someday this person might be a Supreme Court justice. And you do fault the left more than the right for political hobbyism. I mean, the right does think in these terms, doesn't it? I mean, when you look at things, when I look at the field of presidential candidates among the Democrats in 2020, it's a field that doesn't contain a lot of governors because a lot of people didn't get elected governors because of the whole Project Red Map thing and how the Republicans really were able to gain control of so many state legislatures and state governorships.
Yeah, you know, I think there's this thing on the left that because I think most of our media tends to be left, and I think because places like where I work, universities, tend to be left, there is a sense on the left like their positions are self-evidently correct and don't have to be fought for. One of the activists I talked to in the book basically says, I can't really get off the couch because, you know, I'd have to convince someone of something that is obviously right. And on the right, I think there's more of a sense that of kind of beleaguered sense that, you know, institutions are against me, government workers, universities, the media, and I need to work at it to get my views heard. And so I do think that patience for long-term change is also more prominent on the right. And it's also, you know, you see that the right has more institutions, I think, right now that are conducive to long-term party building. On the left, particularly on the you know, white Democrats, we have this massive plummeting of church attendance, weekly church attendance. That's much more common on the right now. And you have institutions on the right like gun clubs, mm-hmm. that do a good job, you know, providing safety classes and building community and leveraging people who don't necessarily care about politics into a political stance. Same thing with churches. On the left, and particularly this kind of college-educated left that is the focus of the book because those are where the hobbyists are most prominent, I think you have fewer opportunities for grassroots engagement. And it's because people feel comfortable with the status quo enough that they're okay with kind of whining online instead of getting their hands dirty into politics.
Let's take a call here. We have John and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. The book is Politics is for Power. Our guest is Eitan Hirsch.
Hi. So I have a question about maybe we shouldn't be as involved. I'm involved in local politics through neighborhood groups, and they tend to be dominated by older and white, I guess it doesn't really matter, but they're older people who don't want anything to change. And so my concern is that certain local politics, maybe I wouldn't say negative, but it's not very inclusive. So how do I include people who don't have the time to go to meetings and that sort of thing into what is the beginning, kind of the base of local politics? How do I get younger people involved?
Yeah, build a new generation. Thanks for that, John. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, a few of the people I have in the book are, you know, college students who do this really well. And I told that, you know, what you're saying resonates with me. I myself is part of a younger group of community activists. But, you know, I have three little kids. It's hard. You know, the folks who show up at town hall every night tend to be older and have time to do that every night. You know, I think the number one thing you can do to get younger people involved in community organizations is, first of all, accommodate their time as much as possible. You know, we've always had struggles. You know, folks want to start meetings at 6 p.m. and I say, can we please start them at 8 so I can put my kids to bed first, that kind of thing. But more another concrete thing is younger people need to be having a stake in organizations and being a seat at a leadership table. I think too many organizations on both sides think of college students or high school students as kind of warm bodies, you know, that they could be grunt workers for an organization. And young people sniff that out and say, I'm not going to be used. But organizations that put high school and college students on a leadership board and say, you know, you're part of the leadership, you're part of the direction of this, those organizations can thrive with a more intergenerational cohort because there's an opportunity for leadership and leadership growth.
You mentioned some examples in the book. Let's talk about the old guard and the college students facing off in Charlotte, North Carolina. How'd that go?
Well, eventually it went well, but this is a group of college students at Davidson, North Carolina, and they decided to start a precinct committee of the Democratic Party, which didn't exist in their town. But the second they did it, and it was initially, it was always from the beginning, both students and some community members. But some of the older guard in that town didn't react well to it. They said, you know, why should these students be involved in local politics? They're transient. They're not going to stay here. And, you know, folks on the left, this is all on the left in this story, you know, who otherwise would, you know, support voting rights and think that they're supportive of increased participation, very quickly can turn a different note when it's about their own community. But what happened was there was a period of transition and trust building, but this committee now in Davidson, North Carolina, is a committee that is both community members and students and faculty at the nearby school. And they did this amazing thing, which is the precinct committee in this town of the Democratic Party, which is a community organization, they have a rule in their bylaws. And the rule in the bylaws is that the student president of the Davidson College Democrats is automatically on the board, the executive committee of this precinct. Now, the thing that I just described to you is almost unheard of. You know, a local political establishment saying, we care so much about partnering with students that we're going to put the president of the Democrats Club, no matter who that person gets a seat on the table, at the table of our leadership committee. That's the kind of thing that is so important for building, for getting younger people engaged.
Just in terms of getting people engaged in elections generally, I almost laughed, and it was a rueful laugh at your report of surveys that say people enjoy voting. I mean, what's going on there? Do they really?
No, they don't. We have really low turnout in this country. And, you know, the elections that they vote in most are these presidential elections where their vote matters the least. But we also have a lot of lying about voting. So, when you survey people and ask them if they voted in a recent election, you know, between a third and a half of them will lie. They'll say they voted when they didn't. And if you look at who's lying, it's amazing because it's college-educated folks who say that they're most interested in politics. So, you know, there's a norm of political engagement among this cohort. They know that voting is a civic duty. They know it's important to be informed. They, they want to be part of the conversation to be able to talk about, you know, Trump or whatever, the presidential primaries. But when they don't get involved, and most of them are not involved in political participation beyond news following, they lie about it.
So you know, obviously there are some opportunities in engaging younger people in particular. I mean, they're all digital natives by this point, so they've been around computers all their lives. I mean, the internet certainly has a power to draw people in, and people do sign petitions and all. But, I mean, does it have to extend from that to more face-to-face work to successfully deliver something?
I think we're learning more and more across the world that internet activism is very good for destruction and not very good for building up. So, you know, I give the example in the book of the Arab Spring, which came across a number of countries in the Middle East and toppled governments in some cases. You know, in Egypt, you have a long-term dictator basically being booted out of power because of a protest in Tahrir Square organized on the internet. The thing is that what happened after the Arab Spring, well, it's called the Arab Winter, that a lot of these countries where there was internet-driven activism turned into places of real sorrow, destruction, tragedy. And that's because groups that were organizing on the internet, they had the ability to organize a protest but not to build a movement, get people on board to knock on doors, get people elected. So the liberal movement that, for example, toppled the government in Egypt, they lost handily an election to the Muslim Brotherhood, which has a network of people who were willing to get out the vote, who showed ordinary people in the Muslim Brotherhood through education and health services that they cared about them. And the kind of detached, placeless left didn't have anything like that. And so I think that's what we're seeing in the U.S. too, to some regard, that, you know, the left might have a lot of energy that it can deploy online and build movements around, getting salience for things like the Me Too movement. But when it comes to voting in elections, which are place-based, you know, it's you register to vote where you live. Groups that have, you know, churches with weekly attenders who are willing to then rely on one another to commit to voting, they're going to get more power in the end.
Huh. It seems like part of the lesson, though, is figure out more than just what you're against. Figure out what you are for.
That's right. And what the path is to get that way. I mean, you know, there's still right now plenty of political books written that are saying, you know, the first thing we need to do is get rid of the Electoral College or get rid of gerrymandering. And, you know, there's no path for that. The only thing there's a path for is building the grassroots up one city at a time, one state at a time, and moving forward that way.
Well, so you probably hear from some people, it's like, well, I'm not a joiner, you know. I don't take part in these clubs and things like that. I mean, what's the response there?
You know, that's why I highlight groups like the Ku Klux Klan in the book, because I want people to realize that if they are not willing to work for it, then they should be comfortable with who's doing it in their place. If they're comfortable with the idea that the KKK is going around offering opioid addicts a helping hand while they stay on the couch, okay, then they'll get what they deserve.
Wow. Okay, something to think about there. Another question, though, about politics in general, though, is there are some people who just feel that there's a general amorality to politics, that you do things that you wouldn't do in other fields just to get the results you want.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. You know, I think that there's what I think about that. Is getting power dirty? Is it dirty to get people to be on board with you to say, let me figure out how to build trust with you so that you'll take the action that I want you to take, to vote the way I want you to vote, to act the way I want you to act? I mean, I don't know why that seems dirty to people any more than any kind of community building is dirty. You know, I sometimes give the example in my own religious life. Whenever we have a new baby born in our community, the community makes that person meals, dinner for about 30 days, and brings it to their house. And it's a pain. We're all working hard in the middle of the night. We're getting dinner ready for the next night for other people. But it's really a community building thing to do. It introduces you to new people. It's a way that makes people feel good about this very stressful time of their life. Now, if you apply that to politics, does it all of a sudden seem dirty? Like if people took care of one another to build rapport and to build connections so that when the moment comes to take some action like vote or engaged, you have this mutual dependence, you have people who rely on one another? You know, I think that people historically, we feel like the political parties have been corrupt and dirty and we don't want to dirty our hands in it, but it's no different than the kind of civic engagement and connectedness that I just described.
Okay, you know, and you probably have to make fewer meals this way, too. The book is called Politics is for Power, How to Move Beyond Political Hobbyism, Take Action, and Make Real Change. It's an urge to stop yelling at the TV, get up off the couch, and actually meet some people who feel the way you do and seek some real political power. It is the work of Eitan Hersh, who is an associate professor at Tufts University in Massachusetts. Eitan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.